Welcome everybody. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Very much to myself. Can everybody hear me clearly? Okay?
Thank you. Yeah.
Today's talk is entitled The Ancient Egyptian Cosmos and the Eternal Repetition of the First Time. The Eternal Repetition of the First Time. The Eternal Repetition. And you'll see repetition is a connecting theme through my talk today, and I will probably end up repeating myself, and I'll be following a very noble tradition of the ancient Egyptians, for whom repetition was the essential thing that kept the cosmos going, that kept the cosmos alive. Audience participation is welcome today. You can help to reenact the Egyptian creation myth by sneezing and coughing and spitting, all in emulation of the creator god Atum. However, for male members of the audience, I wish to not go too far in coughing, perhaps wait for the female to get home. Right, let's start the first slide. I'm sure these pyramids need no introduction. I should say that the amount of stone in these pyramids, there's a great pyramid by the way, which is here, is the tallest. And the latest figures suggest 4 million blocks of stone were used. Not 2.5 million, which is the figure often quoted, but 4 million blocks. Total probably of about 12 million tons of stone. These were built, as you probably know, by Khufu, Khafre, and then Khafre. I'm certainly not here today to challenge that. And before these pyramids, there were 2 pyramids built by Sneferu at Dahshur, which were the first, the earliest true pyramid. The true pyramid, as you probably know, is the smooth-sided pyramid, as opposed to the step pyramid. Something amazing happened in Egypt at that time. Something which arguably Egyptologists have never fully explained. And I wonder whether we really understand the true significance of these monuments. Yes, to some extent, many of them were tombs. Yes, we know they are testimony to a profound belief in the afterlife. That no debate about the fact that they were vehicles for the deceased pharaoh to go on his journey into the other world. No doubt about that. However, I still have a feeling that we don't fully understand the significance of these pyramids and why the pharaohs went to such incredible efforts to erect that much stone. 481 feet is the height of the Great Pyramid. 91 million cubic feet in volume. Why did they go to such enormous lengths? Egyptologists have tried to explain it by reference to a sun cult. They believe that at the time of the 4th dynasty, this is when the Set pyramids stopped and the true pyramids began to be built. They believe that there was a religious development, revolution might be too strong a word, but an important religious development, possibly a change from a star cult to a sun cult. And they try to explain these marvellous monuments in terms of monuments to the sun god, perhaps a representation of the sun's rays sloping down as they pierce a cloud and slope down towards the earth. And I just question whether that really is sufficiently a profound explanation for the enormous efforts that went into building these pyramids. And I know there is a feeling shared by millions of people around the world that there is something inexplicable about these pyramids. There are many, as you probably know, I'm sure you've come across many of the alternative pyramid theories, some might say crackpot pyramid theories, and I think there's a good reason why there are so many crackpot pyramid theories. And the reason is this, that for many, many people, they won't accept that the religious explanation for these makes sense. And because they can't see the logic of the religious explanation for these monuments, they are convinced there must be an economic motive behind the building. That's when we get into the theories such as the Great Pyramid must be a power plant for a lost civilization, or these pyramids were beacons for aliens to navigate their arriving spacecraft on the Earth, or that this pyramid was a water pump. All of these theories are linked by a common theme, which is the pyramids must have an economic motivation. And a chap called Kurt Mendelssohn back in the 1970s followed this pattern of thought too. For him, the pyramids were nothing but a work project by which the state of Egypt was made to come together, a way of getting people to work together, nothing more than that. And for him, he said that the great beauty of the pyramid project lay in the complete uselessness of the final product. It's a lovely quote. And that comes from the same school of thought, that there must be an economic explanation because it is implied the religious explanation is insufficient. That's where I come in. My work over the last few years, which I mentioned in the introduction, the two books, Pyramid of Secrets and Midnight Sun, and the common theme behind those books is that actually Egyptian religion was not simply a sun cult. Yes, the sun was really important, but it was important in the sense of reenacting the creation, and actually it's the creation myth that should be at the centre of the religion. And on that basis, I argue that Egyptian religion is more profound than we give it credit for. And if by the end of today you come to accept my observations, then perhaps we can all go home happily understanding why the pyramids were built and why such efforts were expended to build them. Perhaps we will find that profound motivation which until now has been lacking. Right, let's try. Let's hit the right button. Yes. Good old King Sneferu. One of our heroes, I believe, built the first two pyramids. And I include him here because one of his names, his Horus name, was Ned Mart, the Lord of Mart. How many of you have heard the term Mart? Probably more than half of you. Mart is often translated as the cosmic order. And it really means the harmonic state of order of the cosmos and all the beings in the cosmos, the gods, mankind, and all the different elements of the cosmos, the earth, the sky, the atmosphere, the celestial ocean, everything in a state of harmony, interdependent and working almost like a machine in perpetual motion. Mart was that cosmic order. And the king's role, which we see in the name of Sneferu, Ned Mart, was to ensure that state of cosmic order would prevail. There is a good quote, moving well forward in time to the New Kingdom. There is a treatise on the sun cult, to which it said that Ray placed a king on earth in order to judge men, to provide for the gods, to maintain Mart, the state of order, and to annihilate Ishtar, the state of terror. So very clearly we have lots of evidence through Egyptian history that this was the role of the pharaohs for much of pharaoh history, to maintain the state of Mart, cosmic order. Now Mart, according to his pictures of Paris, Mart was laid down by the creator God himself. And he laid down this famous cosmic order, quite logically, as you might say, at the beginning of time, at the time of creation. That was when Mart originated, in the so-called first time, 1013. So what is that cosmic order? If you look in the Egyptian textbooks, you will never find a depiction of the Egyptian cosmos. That's because the Egyptians never left us a diagram. Which is a great shame. And because Egyptologists are very conservative and a little bit anxious about pushing the boundaries of knowledge too far. So they're very hesitant about taking too many risks in terms of presuming what the Egyptian cosmos actually looks like. However, there's been some good work done by Professor James Allen, on which I've drawn, to reconstruct this diagram. I just have to have a diagram to show as a slide, otherwise it's going to be very difficult to communicate my ideas. So I had to generate this picture myself. But trust me, it's pretty close to what James Allen depicted in his book. So what we've got at the centre of the cosmos is the Earth lying in this pool. The pool is the Nun, or the celestial ocean. Now the celestial ocean exists in two places. It is also the oceanic diamond of the sky. And it's on the surface of this ocean here that the sun, the moon and the stars navigate like boats, sailing on the surface of the celestial ocean. So that celestial ocean is in two places. Half of it is the atmosphere of the Earth and manifests itself in the way of springs and rivers in Egypt. So the Earth, or sometimes called primeval man, rose up out of those primeval waters at the time of creation. A bubble of air, a pressurized bubble of air, was released, according to the myth, by Atum. He exhaled air in the form of the god Shu. So Shu is the god who personified the atmosphere here. And there is some suggestion in the text, my thanks to James Allen for pointing this out to me, that the goddess Tefnut is often mentioned in, nearly always mentioned in connection with Shu as a duality, that Tefnut might personify the lower atmosphere. There is a hint in the text that might have been the understanding. So it would appear probably the Egyptians imagined an atmosphere like this that went right around the Earth. We know in the text there is a reference to an upper sky and there is a reference to a lower sky, almost as two separate parts of the sky being joined here at the horizons, as I'll show you in a moment. So two parts of the sky, two atmospheres, that's the Egyptian cosmos. It gets a little bit more difficult on this slide because for the Egyptians, the visible parts of the cosmos were not enough. It wasn't enough for them to imagine the Earth and the sky which you can see, the atmosphere which you can feel. They also invented other parts of their cosmos, in particular a place called the Duat, which I show here, and a place called the Akhet, which I show here. And a really important question, which has never, I think, been satisfactorily answered, is why the Egyptians were so intent on creating these metaphysical realms of their cosmos, and why they made these metaphysical realms so important. And boy, did they make these realms important, because what you find when you read the Egyptian inscriptions, you find the pyramid text onwards, you find there is evidence that the sun god and the star god could circulate through the sky, and when they reach this point here, you might expect them to continue circulating on the sky. That would seem logical, wouldn't it? However, in the Egyptian text, the emphasis is on a slightly different journey. The gods stop here, they enter into the Akhet through secret doors, and from the Akhet they enter into the interior of the earth, the so-called netherworld, or Duat. They pass through the Duat, also in the Duat you find the primeval waters of Nun, and they exit the Duat here, entering into the Akhet in the east. From the Akhet they then enter back onto the surface of the upper sky, and so their orbit is like this. Isn't that odd? Why would the sun god, star god, moon god orbit through the centre of the Earth? And that's the question that I'm going to try to help to resolve over the next couple of slides. To do that, we need to look a bit more closely at the Duat and the Akhet to understand exactly what they were. Now, briefly on the location of these realms, the Duat, there are some clues in the pyramid text that the Duat was sometimes a border point with the sky, almost similar to the Akhet. And it's possible if you go back into the depths through the mist of time in ancient Egyptian history, possible that the Duat and the Akhet were parallel terms for the same cosmic realm. But over time they became distinguished, so that the Duat was associated almost exclusively with the netherworld, the subterranean part of the Earth. And the Akhet was associated with somewhere, a place more to the east side that led to the sky, and associated more with light, whereas the duat is more associated with darkness, the affect is more associated with light and with spirit. So let's look first at the duat and then at the affect. This is the sign for the determinative for duat. Duat was spelled as duat or dart. And this was the determinative, a five-pointed star inside a circle. And the meaning of the term probably means something to do with twilight or the dawn. And it is possible to translate this as the birthplace of the stars. If we look at the evidence for the duat, we find that it was a birthplace, a place of birth and rebirth for the gods and the king. Nut. The goddess Nut, for example, was said to give birth through the duat, or in a various pets, caused the duat to give birth for her. Also, we find that Horus was born in the duat, but Osiris, I think the late text, Osiris actually begets Horus in the duat. The duat is a place of stars. There are duat gods mentioned in the pyramid texts who have their names determined by three star signs. Osiris is the lord of the duat, and he is connected with the star Sar, which is usually identified with a lion, so it might have been Canopus in the earlier times. So a lot of evidence to link the duat next sign with the star, as you see here. So I rather fancy the translation birthplace of the star. I think it captures what the duat was all about. If we look at the description of the duat, and what I'll try to do in my book is to focus on the earliest texts as much as possible to try and give consistency to the different analyses that I do. In the pyramid text we find that duat seems to be a place of darkness in that it is equated with Amentet, which is another name for the underworld and which signifies a hidden place or a place of darkness. In later times, in the New Kingdom, the books of the Netherworld, the duat is described as a place of thick darkness, which is only brought to light when the sun god passes through the duat and casts his rays in the darkness. Strangely, in view of that darkness, there is a suggestion in the pyramid text and the coffin text that the pyramid text, sorry, that the duat contains green fields. It seems a bit odd in view of the darkness. But there are waters in the duat. The duat is said to be a watery place. The gods and the king navigate through the duat by boats, and there are lakes, duat lakes, mentioned in the pyramid text. There are lots of waters, possibly green fields. Now remember this description because it's uncannily similar to what we're going to find in the Akhet. This is the main hieroglyph for Akhet, which you'll probably be familiar with. It shows the sun disk rising between two hills. So I rather fancy this being of the thighs of the goddess Nut, who is said to give birth to the sun. So this may be the thighs of the goddess lying down giving birth. I think that symbolism works equally well. This is the later hieroglyph. In the pyramid text, the word Akhet is determined by an elliptical sign, which is read as island. And that's quite interesting because that same elliptical sign is used to spell, simply to determine the word for earth, ta. It's the elliptical sign with three dots underneath. So the earth was indeed viewed as an island, in that it is the primeval man in a dish of primeval waters. It is like an island. So the earth was written with a hieroglyph of an island. And the Akhet too was determined by this island hieroglyph. That rather suggests that the Akhet could be a realm of the cosmos, not too dissimilar from the earth itself. Not simply a horizon. Now, let me just say this, the Egyptologists often translate Akhet as horizon. To me, that totally misses the real meaning of what the Akhet actually was. A horizon is simply a cosmic border zone, just beyond our limit of sight. The Akhet is much, much more than that. It appears to be a cosmic realm. It's got doors, it's got an east side, a west side. It seems to have geographical limits. And as I say, it was determined by this island sign, which suggests it was a whole cosmic realm, shaped like an island. Translations of art texts include, inspired by the name Ark. The phonetic root Ark suggests light or radiance or spirit. When the king becomes a spirit, he becomes an Ark. So our text can be translated, has been translated as the land of light, or the island of light, or the place of radiance, or simply the place of becoming Ark, the place of becoming a spirit. Because it is the place in the Pyramid text, the place in the cosmos, where the deceased king, being reborn, is reborn as a spirit, as an Ark. But what about the Akkad? What about its description in the earlier texts? Well, what we find, unlike the Durand, it's not really a place of darkness, it's a place of light. But similarly to the Durand, it is a watery place. Its name is determined on occasions by hieroglyphs of water. It contains lakes. Very interestingly, on the far side of the Ark, it has banks. And on those banks is the great flood, Mehet Weret, the great flood that is bound for the sky. As if that great flood is going to go forth to form the waters of the sky. And it is there, on those banks, by that great flood, that the king finds a place of green fields, a place of contentment, green with fields, which are well stocked with plants. Now that is the description of the Ark. Now for me, that is not describing a horizon, that is describing, it sounds like a tangible cosmic realm, not dissimilar from the Duat or the Earth. A proper cosmic realm. I think Egypt colleges haven't really done justice to that idea. So let's come back to this slide on the circuit of the cosmos and try to make sense of what we've looked at. The big question is, why do the stars, the sun, the moon, and the spirits of the reborn kings, the spirits of the reborn kings become stars, and they follow in the circuit of the sun through the Arket, through the netherworld, or Duat, and then into the Arket and back onto the sky. Why do they do that? What is the obsession in the text with going through the Duat as opposed to circuiting here on the surface of the large sky? And I argue that the reason for it is because simply the Duat is the centre of creation. It is the place from where the creation occurred at the beginning of time. Simply because the Egyptian cosmos was geocentric. Not like today's cosmos, where we believe in a big bang, and in our solar system the sun is at the centre. The Egyptians knew nothing of that. And just like the later Greek civilization, and probably all ancient, we were discussing this last night, probably all ancient civilizations of the Near East believed that the Earth was at the centre of the cosmos. So it's, when you see it like that, it's very logical that they would believe in a geocentric creation in which the Earth, some kind of proto-Earth, not the Earth we know today, but a kind of proto-type of the Earth, was at the centre. And I think Duat is a term that the Egyptians were using to try and render that idea of a realm that doesn't exist tangibly in the world today, but exists as an idea, metaphysically, in the world of the beginning, when the world first began to take shape in the netherworld. I believe that is the Duat. So the Duat is the place of creation. And the Akkad seems to be a snapshot of that creation. So it's the realm of the cosmos, which is coming into being, whereas the Duat is the first snapshot where that primeval cosmos is in darkness and starting to awaken, starting to give birth. Then the Akkad is the next snapshot, the next frame in the sequence of snapshots, where that cosmos is coming to life and filling with light or spirits or radiance. What the sun and the stars were doing, the reason they were revisiting this place here, was to re-engage with the magic of creation. The Egyptians believed that if they didn't keep repeating the creation myth, that the cosmos would collapse back into the state of chaos from which it had emerged. And they believed it was really important to re-perform these mystical acts of creation. We know when the sun came through the galax and emerged from the upper into the sky, we know from the inscriptions that we have that that was regarded as a repetition of the first time, or the first occasion, Tepe. That is written clearly in the text. And that's an important clue to what was going on. So every morning the sun was being born from the Akhet, which was the place of creation. It was also being born, in some texts, he was said to be born from Nut, who was like a mother goddess of creation. And he was born from the Nun, primeval waters. So the sun is being born in a repetition of the original acts of creation. And in doing that, he is rejuvenating the cosmos. So the cosmos for the ancient Egyptians never became more than one day old. It never became old, it never became decrepit. It was always rejuvenated every day by the sun and by the stars who followed the sun through the earth and experienced their own rebirth, just as as stars had been born at the beginning of time through the Duax. Remember, the Nut gave birth to the stars, and Nut gave birth through the Duax. It all hangs together. So I think this is the crucial breakthrough in understanding this circuit of the cosmos. It's all about the creation and the need to reenact the creation. And this is why I refer to the Egyptian religion as a cult of creation. By that, I would define cult of creation as a cult whose primary aim was to reenact perpetually the myth of creation and to celebrate that myth of creation through repeated rituals in order that the cosmos be made to endure forever. Does that make sense? Are people following that? There is only one Akhet, really, but it is placed in the west as a kind of mirror image. I'll mention this because I know somebody will ask at the end, won't they? Why are there two Akhets? I think the answer is there is only one Akhet. There is a poetic representation. Akhet actually probably could extend like this with a graph in the middle of it. It's positioned here poetically to allow the sun, god, and stars to enter into the place of creation. This brings us on to the whole subject of sun god and his union with Osiris in the books of the Netherworld. So-called books of the Netherworld include books such as the Amduat, the Book of Caverns, the Book of Gates, the enigmatic Book of the Netherworld, one of my favorites. All of these books collectively are known as the Books of the Netherworld. We see here a scene from the Book Amduat. Commonly in these books what we find is the sun god passing through mysterious gates into the western Akhet, the west horizon, that's what that really is. Passes into the gates of the western Akhet and enters into the Duat, the Netherworld, the place of darkness, also known as Amentet, the hidden place. And he brings his light to all the beings that are denizens of this dark Netherworld. And the journey, the object of this journey through the 12 gloons or the 6 caverns of the Netherworld is for the sun god to unite with Osiris, and he refers to Osiris as his body. So Ra, Ray, or Ra, travels in the form of a Ba soul and wants to unite with his body. So we've got soul-body union going on, and that happens in the deepest, darkest, middle place of the Netherworld. It is this that gives us the idea of the midnight sun. The midnight sun is a theme picked up in the Greek mysteries, but it originates, as Eric Horman has pointed out in his books, it originates from the Egyptian New Kingdom and the books such as the Amduat, in which it's the sun at midnight, is the sun god in the deepest, darkest hour of the night, engaged in this mystical rebirth with Osiris. And what happens in the text, they don't actually show, not in a way that we can really understand what is happening, but this here is a scene from the enigmatic Book of the Netherworld. This is just one frame in a series. But it's quite interesting, as far as we can tell, what is going on. This is, now I'm going to talk here about interpretation of the scholars, they may be right, they may be wrong. All I can do is tell you what the leading the ecologists are saying about this thing. What the experts say, this representation symbolises the union of Ray and Osiris. These, by the way, are the earliest representations of the Ouroboros serpent, the serpent that swallows its own fat, the earliest representation. So we have here, here's the bar of the sun god, out here, two circles. This is something to do with the union of Ray and Osiris. And in this corner here, we have coffins. One coffin containing the body of Osiris, one body containing, one sarcophagus containing the body of Ray. We've got the sun god and the earth god in close juxtaposition. And this is red as in character. This is the bar of the sun god. And this is where it's copper or sarcophagus too. So there's some mysterious union and rebirth happening here. I would interpret it as the soul of the sun god is uniting in some way with the deceased body of Osiris, the earth god. As a result of that unity, there's kind of spark of life or rebirth, as a result of which both gods revivify, so the deceased god of Osiris sends out his soul. And the sun god Ray, who's in a soul form anyway, is reborn from the body as a soul anew, but he's reborn anew. And the sun god then travels on through the remaining divisions of the duat to emerge from the Atet as a new sun, the sun is reborn again. The Egyptians used to say, Ray is today, Osiris is yesterday. Quite a detour at this point into the idea of the gods in Egyptian mythology. This is a theme from the Book of Gates. So this is in the seventh division of the Netherworld. The sun god's gone on his journey, he feels Osiris in the Netherworld. And then we see something very interesting, which is all these gods asleep in the body of Osiris. Not the idea of the gods asleep in the body of Osiris. And I put this in here really because We need to have a serious talk about Osiris. Osiris is commonly imagined to be an earth god. The god of the dead, you're probably familiar with these ideas. Mm-hmm. The god of vegetation, god of agriculture, rebirth of agriculture, etc. He's a god of the earth, he's a god of death and rebirth. Now hang on, if the creation myth is geocentric, if the creation is arguably an act of an earth god, not an act of the sun god, I would take issue with seeing Quirk, for example, who tries to maintain that creation is always an act of the sun god, but it isn't. Think about the creator god Ptah, he's an earth god. Think about the creator god Khnum. Khnum is an earth god. If the creation is primarily an act of an earth god, and Osiris is an earth god, the god of death and rebirth, then what I'm going to suggest, which is a real challenge to Egyptology, is that Osiris is actually a creator god, in fact, the creator god par excellence. Egyptologists, I know, will try to resist that, because you don't see a typical creation myth in which Osiris acts as the creator god. But to me, in reading these texts, it is implied that Osiris is fulfilling that role of the creation. And what swung it to me was reading the Edfu building text and a book by Eve Raymond called The Mythical Origin of the Egyptian Temple, in which she examines in depth, these are very late texts admittedly, but she examines in depth the Edfu traditions, draw various connections with the Memphite theology, in which the Parthenon is an earth god and a creator god. And she finds a parallel idea in that from her reading of the Edfu text, there was a primeval world, a primeval earth, that died and was revivified and came back to life again. And an earth god emerged from the earth into the temple. We'll discuss this a bit later in the second book, where the earth god emerges and manifests himself in the first temple. But Raymond, Lee Raymond, spotted this idea that creation might actually involve death and rebirth of the cosmos, of a world, some kind of terrestrial or water world in the past that had collapsed into a state of chaos and was then reborn as a new cosmos. And she didn't take it any further than that, because her study was the study of the Egyptian temple. But when I read that, I thought, wow, that is Osiris to a T. Osiris personifies that idea of the old cosmos, which has fallen into a state of decadence and decay, and is then rebuilt, reassembled, and brought back to life again. And here we see the gods in the body of Osiris, an interesting motif to the gods. It's often used as an argument for polytheism in ancient Egypt. And I would urge scholars to penetrate about that, because these gods were seen as a unity, and they belonged together with the Creator God, the Lord of the gods. So the one God and the multiple gods, they all come together in a unity. They are seen as aspects of the one God. And you often see the chief god or creator god in the presence of the assembly of the gods. The assembly of the gods is a massive motif in the pyramid text. Always these gods seem coming together. And in creation mythology, it's the coming together of the gods that causes the creation. Think of the Ogdo in the creation myth of Hermopolis. The eight gods of the Ogdo push together to form the primeval man. We also have other myths where the gods push together to bring Ray into being at the time of creation. So these gods, in the pyramid text, this is another interesting point, the gods are mentioned, the assembly of the gods is mentioned in parallel with the putting together of the limbs of Osiris. Now you'll probably know the main theme of the pyramid text is the dead king becomes identified with Osiris. He becomes known as Osiris the king. Now the rituals which the myths behind mummification are that the body parts of Osiris the king, representing the original god Osiris, to be enactment, have to be found, retrieved and put together to be reassembled, split by Humpty Dumpty, fell off the wall, has to be put back together again. Same with Osiris, it has to be rebuilt, the limb has to be put back together in order to actually come back to life again. And this is a parallel with this idea of the former cosmos in a state of chaos. When I read Osiris' initial state as one of dismemberment, then to me that is an allegory for the state of the cosmos, which was originally in a state of chaos, needs to be brought together. And there are a couple of very interesting texts which I should mention at this point. In the Koffin text, there is reference to Kheb, who is the earth god, pulling together the limbs of Atum to form the primeval man. That's a very important clue to support what I'm arguing. Also, in the Berlin hymns of Ptah, Parthenon is the rising earth god. Now, Ptah Parthenon is said to bring his own limbs of his body together to form the primeval man. So this idea of the limbs being joined together as part of creation myth is absolutely well testified. And I think this is the same thing that's happening with Osiris, the assembly of his limbs, which are sometimes in the pyramid text referred to as iron limbs, limbs made of iron, which I'll mention that because we'll pick it up this afternoon in the second part. Now these echo those other myths of the assembly of the divided parts of the primeval man, or looking at it another way, primeval cosmos, which has fallen into a state of division and needs to be put back together again.
This is too sensitive.
This is a scene from the Book of Gates, where the Sun God is journeying through the Duat and is about to emerge into the Akkad. I love this depiction. Just to take you through it, I think you'll share my fascination with this. But this is the God Nun, who personifies the primeval waters. You see here the primeval waters, which are in the Duat. So Nun is the personification of the primeval waters. He lifts up the bark of Khepri. Khepri was guaranteed for, represents the self-creating creator god, not a sun god. Let's watch out here, let's not call Khepri a sun god. I regard him primarily as a self-creating creator god, who was later co-opted into the sun cult. You see the bark of Khepri. Khepri is lifting up the sun disk. And can you just see here the arms extended to receive the sun disk? those arms belong to the goddess Nut. You see her head here, the body extends, and her feet are standing here on the head of Osiris. And Osiris' body loops around in a circle, and here are his feet resting on his own head. Even Madonna would be proud of that one. And the inscription refers to Osiris, whose body is the Duat, which, as Egyptologists have spotted, seems to suggest that Osiris personifies the entire Duat, which he would, I think that makes sense. And we see that so the sun disk is being lifted here at the same time the sun disk emerges from the Duat king. Question, who is the creator god in this thing? Those ones get very matter written. Well, I would suggest it's probably all of these gods. I think Nun is acting, in some ways, Nun is the creator god. He is the old one. This god from the first time. Nun is a form of creator god. Khafre, we know, is a form of the creator god, the self-creating people. Nut, I would argue, is a kind of mother cosmos. She gives birth to the stars. Her original incarnation seems to be a kind of womb for the earth. And she then gives birth to the stars and ascends up into the sky to become the celestial ocean containing the stars. So she is a creator goddess, and Osiris, I would argue, is a creator god. So I think we've got four different creators showing one thing, which is wonderful for the Egyptians. A wonderful example of the multiple perspectives the Egyptians had looking at one unique moment. The souls of Ra and Osiris uniting the town of Jeru. This is inspired by a passage in the Coffin Text where the god Osiris, the soul of Osiris, is said to enter into the town of Jeru where he meets the soul of Ra and unites with him, fraternizes, unites with him, almost in the sense of, dare I say, copulating with the soul of Ra. And I put this in, but it just brings us back to this mysterious relationship of these two gods, which I think is extremely important. Traditionally, in Egyptology, the relationship of these two gods has been met with disgust and disbelief. Egyptologists can't rationalise why the sun god and the earth god have such a close relationship. It is particularly evident in the books of the Netherworld, which we've just been looking at, where there is this union in the depths of the Duat. It's particularly obvious there. The Egyptologists suspect that that is a kind of priestly fantasy. They believe there was originally a cult of the sun, this cult of the sun being reborn. And they think originally that had nothing to do with the earth god at all. But because we've got kings being buried in tombs in the earth, they think it makes sense that Osiris is then brought into the cult of the sun, kind of merged in a marriage of convenience, so that the rebirth of the sun and the rebirth of Osiris, the earth god, is joined together to the worship of it. And that's a fair enough argument, you know, that does make sense. But I suspect there is more to it. In fact, if you go back to the pyramid text, there are a few hints that suggest that close relationship between Ra and Osiris. Even back in the pyramid text. I won't cite the examples now, but they're referenced in the book. Jan Atman, he's one of my heroes. I know he's very difficult to read, but if you persevere with it, there are some gold nuggets in his book. One of those gold nuggets is that he has come to the view, this book was written in 1984, he's come to the view that Ra and Osiris, perhaps they did belong together after all, and that they represent together the totality of cosmic time. Jan Atman is very interesting when he writes about the concepts of Neke and Jet. Neke is eternal repetition, and Jet is eternal duration. The idea was if you eternally repeat the acts of creation, it will result in Jet, which is a state of endurance of the cosmos. So Neke and Jet, these crucial terms. For Jan Atman, Ra is the god of eternal repetition, because he's eternally going round the cosmos. repeating and repeating that circuit through the place of creation, being reborn as he was at the beginning of time. So Ray is the god of eternal repetition, and Aston identifies Osiris as the god of eternal endurance, or eternal duration. So the eternal orbiting of Ray through the Duat results in the eternal endurance of the mummy of Osiris, which represents the cosmos perpetually coming back to life again. So the cosmos is perpetually being rejuvenated and made young. So Aston sees a profound connection at last from life in Egyptology. And I would just take it a step further and say to Aston, okay, I agree with you about jet time, what he calls Neo time and jet time. Let's add one other leg in and form a triangle, and that is the first time. Because it's the first time that is all important. It is the first time, the time of creation, which results in the idea of repetition. The sun cannot repeat until the first time has given birth to the sun. Once the sun appears, it can begin its own repetition of creation. Those eternal repetitions lead to the eternal endurance of the cosmos. The eternal endurance of the cosmos that was created at the first time, that topic. So I think this is the diagram that makes sense of the Egyptian concept of time, and indeed the whole concept of religion, which is aimed at maintaining the cosmos, rejuvenating it, maintaining it in its state of Mars. Mars is the other key term. I think if we had this Egyptian religion, a single word, that word would probably be Mars, cosmically. That's what it was all about. As this is a lecture about eternal repetition, I'll just repeat some of these ideas to make sure you understand. This is an extract from the Midnight Sun. I'll just run through this because I know it's repeating, but I think this will help to consolidate what I'm saying. The ancient Egyptian cosmos was a perpetual motion machine designed to function for millions upon millions of years. The system possessed not so much longevity as immortality, an idea enshrined in the divine principle Jet, translated eternal duration. Eternal duration was dependent upon the orbital motion of the cosmos. The sun, moon and stars were required to orbit according to preordained cycles, while on Earth, the land of Egypt, the river Nile had to flood in its due season and bear produce. These recurrent cycles enshrined the divine principle Nehe, which is translated eternal repetition. Eternal repetition is not understood in the modern sense of repeating the previous event or cycle, but in the ancient sense of repeating the original event or cycle, which had been initiated by the Creator God at the beginning of time. Every sunrise was thus the original sunrise, every new moon was the original new moon, every new star was the original birth of that star, every Nile flood was the original flood that covered the earth, every emergence of land was the original emergence of the earth from the waters, the primeval man, and every coronation of the king was the coronation of the original king. In short, every day was the first day, as was yesterday, as was tomorrow. And just a few more paragraphs. The eternal endurance of the cosmos was thus brought about by the eternal repetition of a design that had been established at the time of creation. This primeval age was known as Tepi, translated the first time for the first occasion. It witnessed the establishment of Mart, the cosmic order. Mart was a system of laws that governed the cosmos, not just the celestial order, nor just the earthly order, nor just the divine order, nor just the human order, but the complete cosmic order, in the sense that all manifestations of spirit and matter were harmonically interdependent for their continued existence. Such was the importance of this concept, but if we had to describe the Egyptian religion in a single word, if we had to, then that word would be Mars. The eternal repetition, Nehe, of the events of the first time, Tepi, thus guarantees the continuance of the cosmic order, Mars, and in turn, the eternal endurance, Jet, of the cosmos. The cosmos was thus a perpetual motion machine with an ever unchanging order conceived as a virtuous circle of time. With references to the diagram we just saw. Does it make sense?
Yes.
Back to the pyramid. The pyramid was a centre of eternal repetition, as was every Egyptian temple. At the pyramid, it was the temple, the worship temple, on the east side of the pyramid. That was the centre of the rituals of repetition. There's a very interesting inscription in, well, this is obviously before the time of the pyramid text, this is the great one, but in the pyramids that have pyramid text, there's a very interesting inscription which goes as follows, I recall. It says, the king's afterlife is Nehe, the king's limit is Jet. So, in other words, the king's afterlife is eternal repetition, the king's limit is eternal duration. It goes on to say, this king is one who rises and rises, who endures and endures. And then it goes on to say, the pyramid of the king will be among the living in this land forever and eternity. And the words forever and eternity, Nehe and Jet. So these two terms, Alaskan has correctly identified, pop up in all sorts of interesting places. And they're usually translated forever and eternity. But when you're reading the translation and you see those words, it's probably a rendering of Nehe and Jet. And there's more to it than forever and eternity. It's about eternal repetition, creating eternal endurance of the cosmos. And this pyramid, we'll talk a bit more about this in the second part of the talk, is actually called Akhet Khufu. And it's unique among the pyramid names. The other pyramid names generally refer to visions of the king going to the other world. They talk all about him rising and enduring, his places are pure and sacred. The vision of the king in the afterlife. But this particular pyramid name, Akhet Khufu, is different because it's the only one that relates to a part of the cosmos. Mainly the Akhet, which we've been talking about earlier. So the land of light, the place of the sun, Akh. This is a representation of that cosmic realm, the Akhet. And perhaps, for some of you, might be starting to make sense in terms of understanding the symbolism of the pyramid. Not simply the sun's rays floating down to the earth. Not simply the primeval man, though they are the primeval man, the ground on which the pyramid is built. The Duat, in fact, is here, the Duat on Netherworld. And what we see with the pyramid, the true pyramid, is the original cosmos in its process of rebirth. So the Akhet, remember, is a snapshot, the Akhet is a snapshot of the unfolding creation. But this also is a snapshot of the Akhet. Perhaps it's the only, in a sense, the only Egyptian depiction of the creation taking place. Actually, that's not true because temples are also simulacri of the creation process. We'll talk about that in the second part. But here is a picture in the shape of a pyramid of the cosmos in its process of creation, rising up out of the abyss, rising up out of the duat, in this pyramidal shape, which to me suggests flow, suggests that flowing action of materials, light that is coming up out of the darkness of the netherworld in order to give birth to the cosmos. At this point, at this snapshot of creation, the new cosmos does not yet exist. There is as yet no sky, there is as yet no stars or sun and moon. There is the netherworld below and the Akhet emerging from it. And the point, the apex of the pyramid is the seed of creation, which is about to create that moment of magic which will result in the transformation of the cosmos, will result in the birth of the stars, the sun and moon, and the celestial ocean. All that will yet to come. This is just a snapshot, just before the end. Pyramid texts, I'm sure most of you will be familiar with them, they first appear in the pyramids with Unas toward the end of the 5th dynasty and then continue in the pyramid Saqqara during the 6th dynasty. And they have traditionally been regarded as a bit of a mishmash, full of inconsistencies and contradictions, because the pyramid text, the whole Egyptian religion of that era, has been seen as a tongue cut. And when the Egyptologists read in these texts about the king becoming a star, not necessarily a star in the path of the sun god, but he might become a star in the northern circumpolar sky, where the stars just stay fixed or visible. they see contradictions between the king becoming a star of the north and the king becoming the sun, or a star accompanied the sun constantly when they're over the horizon. Is that really a contradiction? I suspect not. And if we accept my premise that Osiris was the creator of planet Equinox, then what is actually happening in the pyramid text, where the king is becoming an image of Osiris, is that the king is reenacting the rebirth of the creator, reenacting the rebirth of the cosmos itself, which the creator personifies. He personifies that person. So when Osiris, when the king becomes Osiris, the king, and Osiris is then transformed and goes on his journey through the Duat, through the Akat, even into the sky in form of Horus, then what he's doing is he's been reborn in exactly the same way as the creator God was born and went up from the Duat to the sky at the beginning of time. So earth and sky are linked together fundamentally. Traditionally, you just want to get to see earth and sky as two different parts of the cosmos, not connected. You've got an earth god, Osiris, you've got a sun god and star god, or part of a sky cult. You've got a sky cult, you've got an earth cult. They can't see how the two link together. I believe they did link together, but it was a creation cult in which the earth was at the centre of creation, and it was an earth god who was the creator god. And as a result of that creation, the gods went up to the sky. All quite logical. So in the pyramid text, the various destinations of the king in the afterlife are not contradictions, because if you think about it, all things were created at the time of creation. So if the king is being transformed into the sun or the moon or the stars, that is as we would expect, because that is what the creator is. When he develops himself into the cosmos, he develops from the primeval cosmos, he develops into the primeval man, he develops into the celestial ocean, and the atmosphere which supports him, he develops into it, the sun, moon, and stars. That is the unfolding process of creation, which the God personifies. So, I suspect the pyramid text is actually a lot more coherent than scholars give them credit for. And, probably a further repetition, but this slide again, and I've added in the field of reeds, because I think it's just worth saying a few words about the king's journey in the afterlife. After the king dies, he's reborn as a spirit. And he starts to circulate through the cosmos in company with the sun and the stars. And what is interesting is there's a place called the Field of Reeds, which it actually exists in two places. It's part of the sky, it's part of the dawn sky. So the one I've shown here is part of the underworld. And it's a place of green fields and floods, floodwaters. I believe it's another snapshot of the creation taking place, which seems to draw on mythology from the Ekri creation myth, where the creation takes place in a reed swamp. And you find reed, the king sails on reed floats and goes to the sky. There are connections here with the reeds, the reed swamps, and the Ekri creation myth. The field of reeds in this field, this waterlogged field, land emerges, which is a dead ring of the creation. And what is interesting is the crops. You'll probably be familiar with the idea of the celestial fields in which the king would go and he'd reap the crops and get his nourishment from the crops. We've all come across those representations, haven't we? And they're very popular in the Book of the Dead. We see those representations all the time. And it's often been said that these are representations of the Elysian fields, the Greek paradise. It's not the same thing. In the Greek belief system, the Elysian fields is where you went and you stayed there. You went into the afterlife and you stayed in the Elysian fields. But if you look at the Egyptian pyramid text, this is just a transit point in an orbit of the cosmos. Sure, the king goes to the east, to the field where he reached the cross, but then he goes up into the sky and again he goes to the fields in the sky. What seems to be happening is he's gaining nourishment from eating the fruit of these fields. They give him nourishment and power to sail forth into the sky. When he's into the sky, he finds the celestial river Nile with banks and fields. The whole sky is known as the field of offerings. It is a field in which the king can harvest the crops once again. Three seasons in a single night magically produced by the sunlight, so the king can harvest and eat the crops once again to get more nourishment to continue his journey down through the Rakhet. And interestingly, when he comes into the Duat to visit his body double, which is a soul, the king's governor of the soul, or spirit, remember, he comes, he meets his, at a union with his own body double in the tomb, and he brings the offerings from the sky into the tomb, which I find really interesting, because those are genuinely divine archetypal offerings. They're not the offerings of this world, which the priests bring for the tomb. What the king and the archetype is doing is provisioning his own archetypal food from the celestial fields and bringing it into the tomb. And then the body is imagined to be waking up and eating these crops and gaining nourishment. And that's helping the rejuvenation of the body, allowing it to send forth its soul. Its soul comes forth again to build reeds to provision more nourishment. And so on and so forth. The cycle continues on and on ad infinitum. Thank you for listening. That's the first talk. So I'm going to have a break and come back.
Thank you very much.
This part of the talk is going to be about my book, Primitive Secrets. I would ask to say a few words about symbolism of temples and pyramids as an introduction to my ideas about the Great Pyramid. So, with the Egyptian temple, we don't have a lot of evidence from the earlier period. Most of our evidence of temple symbolism comes from the Great Pyramid. There is ample evidence that Egyptologists will actually say it is a fact. It's not often given uncontested fact in Egyptology. They will say it is a fact that the temple of the late period was a representation of the cosmos in the process of creation, which is, for me, the most corroboration, in a sense, of my theory about the pyramids, because it establishes the principle of a work of architecture in ancient Egypt and represents the cosmos in process of formation. It proves that that was an important idea to the Egyptians, at least in the late period. And so, I suppose the controversy is whether that could also be the case in the old kingdom period. But with the temple, the idea was the floor signified the primeval man, which had emerged from the primeval ocean. The temple signified the separation of the sky from the earth. That's a major part of all the creation myths that we have. And at the roof of the temple, the ceiling, signified the sky. And it was decorated with images of the stars and goddess and arts. So that's the cosmic symbolism of the temple. I've put in a picture here of the temple of Philae, because there's an interesting inscription there. It states that this temple came into being when nothing else at all had yet come into being, when the earth still lay in darkness and obscurity. It's a lovely inscription which conveys the idea that the temple is a mythical idea. It represents a mythical idea to do with creation. And Eve Rayner, as I mentioned earlier, is an excellent book, it's out of print, I forget, called The Mythical Origin of the Egyptian Temple. Her work focuses on Edfu, the building text inscribed on the walls of the temple at Edfu, which goes a long way to showing that that particular temple was one of the representations of the mythical temple of the first time. The idea was that the gods themselves had built the first temple in Egypt. Not of stone, it was built of reed, according to the Egyptian myth. They constructed a perch and a shelter and a reed temple for the falcon god, the primitive falcon god, later known as Horus. That's the Egyptian creation myth. Which I think there's another aspect to that which Eve Raymond didn't quite apprehend, which is that the temple is actually a cipher for the entire cosmos. So when it says the gods built the first temple at the first time, that means the gods built the cosmos. I think the gods built the temple, but the temple signifies the cosmos, built the cosmos, and the gods built the cosmos. So coming back to inheritance. Again, which is slightly different. It's a well-haired theory. Hesitate to say back to Egyptology, coming back to contemporary. Well-haired theory that the pyramid has connection, profound connection with the Obelisk and the Benben stone. The Benben stone, you see here, is thought to have been a conical shaped stone which stood on a pillar in the temple of Heliopolis. So that temple without just ruins, just a foundation with all that remains of it. The temple of Benben, we don't know exactly where in Heliopolis that was. The stone itself no longer exists. But there is every suggestion that it was some kind of archaic cult stone, possibly a meteorite. Several Egyptologists have suggested it was a meteorite, but that is a theory that we can't prove it. But the thing with meteorites, I know a little bit about meteorites, I have one at home, and I used to have two. And the other one I used to have used to rust a lot. And there is a problem with meteorites. If you look at iron meteorites, I'm talking about, iron meteorites will rust and decompose over hundreds of years before it disintegrates and falls apart. So if the Benben stone was originally a meteorite, perhaps in archaic times, then by the time it was pyramids, then it probably would have rusted and fallen apart. Especially the way it's exposed to all the elements on top of the pillar. Because if you want to keep a meteorite in good condition, that's the last thing you should do with it. You should in fact keep it in an air-conditioned cabinet. Keep the humidity to a steady 30 degrees. Temperature fluctuations are very bad for meteorites, and exposure to humidity and water is disastrous. So if the Egyptians put a meteorite on top of a pillar like that, they were asking to find it. So it probably ended up, if it wasn't a meteorite originally, it probably ended up as a stone which was thought to be a meteorite, even though it wasn't actually a meteorite. It might have been a symbolic meteorite. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Or they what we call amphoras, or bichirus. Anyway, that's the idea of the Benben pillar. And any of you who have studied the obelisk will know that the theory is that the obelisk is an extension of the original Benben stone. So it was inspired, in other words, it was inspired by the original Benben fetish on the pillar. And I think to prove that, the apex of the obelisk was called Benben. Benben, the name echoes the name Benben. It seems to mean little Benben, or maybe it's the feminine ending on the word Benben, which is quite interesting. And that same apex appears on top of the pyramid. So the capstone of the true pyramid is also called Benben, or Benben stone. So it has been said by authorities such as Mark Lehner, the notorious pyramid expert, that decode the symbolism of the Benben stone, then you can appreciate the symbolism of the entire pyramid. So what is the symbolism of the Benben stone? Unfortunately, this is where Egyptologists, I think, have taken a wrong turn. They have regarded it as a sun stone. It's that obsession with the sun cult again. On very tenuous evidence, they try to make an etymology from the word wavelength, and it's light, which I find quite fanciful, and much more likely etymology is from the word ben, which means it's a sexual term in the Egyptian language, and it means to impregnate by means of copulation, as in male, female, sexual bonding. And that's ben, and then ben, from the repeat term ben, that means the flow. And there is an excellent inscription at the Temple of Thoth in Thebes that states, it refers to the god Amun-Re in the sense of him being the creator god. And it says Amun-Re begat the place in the primeval ocean at the first time when the seas flowed, Benben, out from underneath his body. The implication of that is that the seas flowed out and became a primeval man. Mm-hmm. So Benben means the flow, and the etymology for the Benben stone therefore would be the stone that flowed out, being implied it flowed out at the time of creation. film tax then ends by repealing an offer of 600. This is a purely an artist's illustration of what the temple of the Benben might have looked like. This temple of the Benben is mentioned in Offering 600, and what Offering 600 states is, O Artem Kepler, that's Artem the creator god, joined together with the scarab, self-creating creator god, the scarab people. O Artem Kepler, you became the high hill, you rose up as the Benben stone in the temple of the Bennu bird or Phoenix in Heliopolis. So this is an illustration of that Utter 600 Benben stone rising up, Artem rising up in front of the Benben stone. Egyptologists have long scratched their head over this passage, and I think again they've taken a long turn because they assume that the Benben stone is a parallel term for the high hill, and that both refer to the primeval mounds. So in other words, they're saying, all they're saying, the text says, is that Artem rose up as the primeval man, the high hill of Benben being the primeval man. So that's the second theory for the Benben stone. On one hand, they think it might be a sunstone, on the other hand, they're saying it may represent the primeval man. In my humble opinion, both theories are completely wrong. And Benben stone, in fact, signifies something more than that. And I think the truth is that's not too strong a word, lies in the obvious inscriptions. Various obelisks, there are inscriptions which state that the Benben, the apex of the obelisk, reaches to the sky and mingles with the sky. The obelisk is a sky split, or splits open the sky. And that, to me, demonstrates beyond much doubt that the Benben, the level of the Benben stone here is the sky. At least as the sky is coming to being at the time of creation, this is the feed that's going to impregnate that sky as it comes into being. That is more than primeval man. Primeval man is the earth, which is the ground, and this is raised up above the earth. What I think it signifies from my work on the creation myth, which again I must emphasize is a geocentric cosmogony, with the elements being raised up from the earth. So the earth is at the center. In my reading of the Egyptian myth, there is a kind of cataclysm, a splitting of the primeval cosmos, the surface of the proto-earth splits open, and there is an ejection of primeval matter. Now this is, of course, the myth of Artem expelling Shirin Tefnut. What a dramatic, fiery expulsion of matter, which produces the atmosphere in the form of Shu, moisture perhaps, signifying the sky in the form of Tefnut. That is an ejection, ejaculation of matter from the heart of the old cosmos, from the Uats. And the Benben, I believe, signifies that matter, primeval matter that's being ejected up into the sky. An interesting element in the Persian text is something called Bajar, which is translated as iron. There are many references to Bajar and Pet, the iron of the sky. So there is no dispute the Egyptians believe there was iron in the sky. And there are many interesting references in the Roman text and common text to this time. They refer to the king in the afterlife sitting on a throne of iron, which I believe refers to the primeval man. But there is also references to the king's limbs being transfigured into the sky, the king's bones being of iron, and the limbs of the king being the imperishable stars. There are several references which suggest strongly that the stars were made of iron. There's nothing conclusive about the sun and the moon and what that was made of, but certainly with the stars, very suggestive that they were made of this bajar material of iron. So if this was an iron meteorite, that would be very, very relevant indeed. What this is, Egyptologists have described this as the solidified seed or semen of Artem. But to find that, we have to read Henri Crapple, King of the Gods, page 484, footnote number 252. It's hidden in the footnotes, as if he's too embarrassed to state it openly. I think one of the problems here with early Egyptologists is they were a bit squeamish with some of the sexual references in the Egyptian text. Maybe they were a bit shy of declaring that all the major architectural forms were such in imagery. Daniel's stone, this utterance 600 of the present text is echoed in another utterance, I think 527, where Artem masturbates his phallus. I think that's also in Theodocles. So there is a parallel between the two utterances, which would tend to suggest that this is an image of Artem's phallus. And I think Frankfort certainly agrees with that, but I believe it's probably just a little bit shy of pronouncing it. So the Venom Stone, if that's a phallic symbol, then the obelisk would also be a phallic symbol if it carries the Venom on the edge. And the pyramid itself would be a filled out form of that phallic symbol too. And why not? Because you know, the phallus is all about issuing seed, and seed or semen was at the heart of fertilizing and creating in the Egyptian creation book, especially in the Middle Ages. Right, that's the Venom. So we come to the Great Pyramid, which came from some of my focus here. Anyway, that's the Great Pyramid again, which we've seen is called Akhet. And I might just add at this point a couple of extensions of this. In the Pyramid text, there are a couple of interesting references. One of them identifies the pyramid, not this pyramid, this is the Great Pyramid. One of the Pyramid texts identifies the pyramid with Osiris. It takes something like a horse to take yourself to the pyramid. This pyramid is Osiris. That's quite an interesting inscription which scholars have struggled to comprehend because Osiris, the god of the underworld, the god of the dead, and they can't understand why the Egyptians would call the entire pyramid Osiris. But the answer lies in other inscriptions in pyramid texts in which Osiris the king is given the name Akhet, from which Ray goes forth. That appears in two or three inscriptions. It makes the connection, therefore, between the pyramid, the Akhet, and Osiris. We already know that this pyramid, going back to the fourth dynasty, was called Akhet Sufu. So the idea that the pyramid is then called Osiris, and that Osiris is the Akhet, from which Ray goes forth, creates this quite strong connection link, which is self-consistent, internally consistent and logical. Why was this this? I think the answer to the conundrum is that Osiris was not simply a god of the dead, he was a god who sent out his soul or spirit from the Duat up into the Akhet. And from the Akhet then Ray went forth into the newly created cosmos. So it makes sense that this might represent not the body of Osiris, because the body of Osiris belongs in the Duat, in the earth. This represents the spirit of Osiris, the Akh, the spirit of the god, which has emerged from the Duat. So, the Great Pyramid, we know it's called Akhet Khufu. And it appears to symbolise the Akhet, or the realm of the cosmos, a snapshot of the cosmos coming into being. So it's quite a strange idea to get your head around because it's a big pile of stone, and yet remember our earlier description of the Akhet containing waters and green fields and plants. And try to see the pyramid through new eyes, perhaps. It's a representation of stone of a cosmic idea. And so we come to the strange, unique internal construction of the Great Pyramid. Just briefly, the entrance passage, as is the norm, is on the north face. It slopes down a long way to a subterranean chamber, which is 100 feet underground. This is a very strange cave, a cavern, which seems to have been deliberately carved with stalagmite features on the ground, sort of growing up. But I was speaking with somebody, a friend about this recently, who said there were actually chisel marks here in the cave. Egyptians would normally resort to a chisel only when they were just about finished on their work, which would indicate that this is not an unfinished cavern, but was deliberately designed to look the way it looks. Quite puzzling, but maybe they were, one of my theories for this cavern is that they were trying to represent a cavern they actually knew that existed somewhere else. Trying to recreate something they already knew. Perhaps it was is going to be pushed. Anyway, that's the subterranean chamber. Then there's a queen's chamber, so called queen's chamber by the Arabs, nothing to do with the queen as far as I know. Called so by the Arabs because of its sloping roof. And then number four here is the Grand Gallery, which is fantastic Baroque architecture. Not the chamber per se, it seems to be a glorified passageway up to the King's Chamber, which is here, number five is the King's Chamber. Again, it's called the King's Chamber, but not necessarily anything to do with the King. Though each of the projects believe it was, of course. Now, the standard theory for these various chambers, the King changed his mind. He had the underground chamber built initially, then changed his mind, felt it wasn't safe enough, he wanted to be very high up. So we created this concealed passageway here, the ascending passage, and then concealed the queen's chamber below the bridge of stone here. And then changed his mind again and decided to be very even higher up in the king's chamber. This change of mind theory has been widely criticised, and most Egyptologists seem to have migrated over to form a new consensus, which is that the chamber system was designed in its entirety from the beginning to be like this. And I suppose back at that statement you can see the pyramid of secrets, a summary of quotes from many of the leading pyramid experts all agreeing now that this is a unity of design. However, having got that far, they are at a loss really to explain what each of these chambers was used for. The only area where there is a strong consensus is that this, the King's Chamber, was the tomb of Khufu. No, they got good grounds for saying so. So, as a result of my work on creation myth and creation symbolism of pyramids, I find myself very uncomfortable with this idea that this was a tomb. And the prime reason for that is the religious. For the ancient Egyptians, they were saying in the pyramid text, the body to earth, the spirit up to the sky. And you find that saying in various forms almost throughout Egyptian history where they've got textual evidence. And that would suggest that the body of the king should be buried down here in the earth of the Duat, and that the Ap, or spirit of the king, belongs here. And remember, this is called Akhet Uta. So this Akhet is the place of the Ak. Therefore, body to earth, Ak, spirit to the sky. This whole pyramid superstructure should have been confined to the spirit of Khufu. What I would expect based on my understanding of religion, of the cult of creation, is that king's body would have been buried somewhere below ground level, and the king's spirit was expected to rise up and fill the pyramid, and would have had free run of all these passageways and chambers above. Food for thought. The reason why the Egyptologists are so confident about the king's chamber, this is the king's chamber, it had a height of 140 feet inside the superstructure. There was no other Egyptian tomb at such a height above ground, which immediately I smell of that. Maybe the Egyptologists believe that Khufu broke the precedent to try and make his tomb more safe from the tomb bodies. Who knows? Maybe not. But I do have trouble with it. But the main reason I will argue he was buried here is this sarcophagus, which is about the right size for a human body. Somebody wrote a nice caption for this, which was another best-selling author finds himself in a tight spot. This sarcophagus originally had a lid. There are remains of bolts still embedded in the side of the coffer. They were sunk in using a hot resinous glue, and the lid was originally between 10 and 12 inches thick. It itself weighed about 2.5 tons, and remarkably has been removed from the chamber. The reason the box is still there is because it's too big to be removed through the passageway. Now, interestingly, the corner of the box is broken here, and this suggests that when the first people, the intruders into the pyramid, discovered this box, that they broke one corner here, looked inside, and then, only then, decided to remove the whole lid. I mean, if you think about it, it was a hell of a task to remove that black lid. So they must have had a compelling reason to do so. If they looked in the corner and the box was empty, they probably wouldn't have bothered. So, valuable inside this box. So there are very good brands, particularly with the size of the box as well, very good brands have started to assert that this was the tomb of Khufu. Of course, we have no evidence of a mummy, no evidence or record of a mummy having been found in the pyramid or removed from the pyramid at any time. Again, historical reference I can think of is Herodotus, who, based on his discussions with the priest Giza, declared that Khufu had been buried underneath the pyramid, which I find quite interesting and corroborates my theory. So he was buried underneath the pyramid. But that's the rationale. The painting of Khufu was very good. Why was it removed? Granite was a valuable stone in Egypt. Even though it weighed 2.5 tons. And I think it's amazing how determined they were to remove granite from the pyramid. You won't see in this actually. The lecture I often do shows the four post blocks that were removed from the antechamber, 21 inches thick granite slabs protected this chamber, and they were removed from their slot and taken all the way down the passageways to the bottom of the pyramid. So they did move granite, and I guess whether the lid came off in one piece or in one piece, who knows, but they removed it. There's good evidence that it was fitted originally. So, if anybody wants to challenge the theory that Khufu was buried there, they've got to come up with a compelling theory for something else being concealed in this box. To take Moses' stone, this is where I come in. I think, well, I know I've got a good theory, maybe, like any theory, it could be right, it could be wrong. But I've got a good theory of what this box contains. And the answer is meteoritic iron. I think we have a picture here. This is a yours truly having sweet dreams on a meteorite iron pillow. This is an iron meteorite that I bought in the year 2000. It was a Campo del Cielo, came from Argentina, thousands of years old. It weighed 33 kilograms. You can barely lift it. It's really, really dense. It consists of iron nickel alloy. Originally, I guess, an asteroid, perhaps a comet. Anyway, that's the science. We get the science. We're interested in mythology. And the Egyptians regarded these meteorites as the essence of creation. For the Egyptians, a meteorite didn't originate from an asteroid belt. It didn't fall out of the sky having originated in the sky. For the Egyptians, the meteorites, the iron, originated from the earth. Because remember, we're talking of a geocentric cosmogony. The iron, it appears to be, was blasted out from the earth up into the sky. Hence iron came to form stars, and at a later date when elements of this iron fell back in the form of meteorites, the priests regarded this as sacred material of the creation, actual samples of the seed or seed of Aten. So you can imagine how holy they would have regarded such an object. So on those grounds, I have proposed in my book Pyramid of Secrets that the answer to the riddle of King Senga is at least this iron was enshrined in that box. It also makes sense because, as I mentioned earlier, iron has a tendency to corrode and disintegrate and fall apart. If you, you want to stop a meteorite from rusting, what you have to do is to shut out the air and control the humidity. If you seal this in a box with an airtight seal, a metal seal, as in the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber, then the iron would have been preserved and would not have lost it. So it would in effect have mummified the meteorite. I'm sometimes asked, what about the shape of the box? Did they have to have a human-sized box to put an iron meteorite into it? And there are all sorts of answers I can give to that. One of the thoughts that occurred to me recently, there is a passage in the Pyramid text where it refers to Osiris and his iron limbs. So this is Osiris, not a human being, or human king, obviously. He's a god, but he's pictured poetically in anthropomorphic form, in a human-like form. So he's, despite many Egyptian gods and goddesses, he's portrayed poetically as if he had arms and legs. And there is a passage in the Pyramid text which refers to Osiris stretching out his iron bones and limbs within the body of the goddess Nut. Many of you will know the goddess Nut in later times was represented by the sarcophagus thing, which was seen as nuts enclosing the sun's eyes and the mummy's eyes. So there is actually a passage in pyramid text which corresponds exactly to my image of iron being inside this box. So the box filled with nuts and the king's iron bones inside stretched out within the womb of nuts. That's in pyramid text. So maybe one meteorite, maybe there was maybe some kind of statue made up of iron that had been smelted from meteorites to create an iron body. This is a thought that has occurred to me since I am good. Did somebody want to
Yes,
yeah.
Sorry, would that have been worth stealing then?
Absolutely.
From
iron. Into the iron.
If it were a tumor, but would they have appreciated what it was in the
I think they very quickly would realise that it was worth a lot of money, because in ancient times, as far as we can tell, there was an international trade in meteorites. Meteorite iron, part of the old kingdom, the iron that fell out of the sky, was the only source of iron that the ancient people knew. And it was therefore used. In Egypt, it was mainly used for making fetish shoes and religious objects. But it did come to be used for making weapons. So it was valuable. A, from a religious point of view, but also from an economic material point of view as well. It was very valuable material. The iron was quite rare and hard to get, and meteorites were the only source of it. And meteorites didn't fall that often. At least today they didn't fall that often. They might have fallen more frequently than other kingdom sites, we don't really know. So, now, I'll just mention with meteorites that there is precedent or meteorites being raised up on high. Now, the Kengen stone we discussed earlier, you remember, is lifted up on a pillar. The Kengen stone may arguably have been an iron meteorite originally. So that would give us possible precedent number one. Precedent number two, the Kalmuta object worshipped like this. Articles by Gerald Wainwright and JDA, a series of articles argue that the Egyptians worshipped iron meteorites, and there was a particular small meteorite worshipped at Thebes called the Kalmuta. And in Egyptian myth, it is stated that the Kalmuta was lifted up to the sky at the time of creation. So that's precedent number two, the idea that an iron meteorite is lifted up to the sky. Adding to that, my rationale, the reason why the meteorite is lifted up, because it signifies the expulsion of primeval elements into the sky. And I think we've got a good case, rightly or wrongly, but we've got a good theory for meteorite iron being interred inside this box. That enables us to think again about where Kingsbury might have converged. This is going to be a testable theory, not one of these theories that can never be proven or disproven, but to which to some extent it is testable. So just a few more words on the King's Chamber and the idea of the meteorite. A unique feature of the King's Chamber, which we don't find anywhere else in the Egyptian pyramids or tombs, is the so-called air shafts, which are cut into the wall. These are about 8 inches, I think it's about 8 inches by 6 inches, this aperture. And it goes up about 274 feet to the outside of the pyramid. This is the one in the north wall. There's also another one in the south wall, which is today fitted to an electric fan. There are a couple of theories on these shafts. One is that they were built to bring ventilation into the king's chamber. But some people don't believe that. But why would you need to ventilate? But then again, other scholars argue that because the pyramid was, the chamber was built at such a distance into the pyramid, so high up in its masonry, that it did need to bring an intake valve. So that's quite a contentious theory. The other theory, of course, is that the king was buried in here and his soul proceeded up into the sky by passing through the shafts. Who knows, that may be possible. One of the justifications for that theory is that in the original scheme where the king's tomb was on the ground, there was always an entrance passage oriented to the northern sky. And that if you lifted the tomb high up into the body of the pyramid, as they think happened here, then you need to bring a substitute or model northern shaft to enable the king to proceed to the sky in the same way that he used to do up the entrance passage. So this is seen to some as a model more than ancient passage. But the problem with that theory, and it's a big problem, is that if that was the case, we'd only expect a shaft in the north wall of the king's chamber, and there is in fact a shaft in the south wall, very similar to this shaft. So that rather throws a spanner in going to that particular theory. I'm not convinced anybody really ever solved the mystery of these shafts, especially when you consider the incredible events that the stonemasons went to cut these shafts obliquely up through the masonry levels of the pyramid. Rudolf Gantenbrink's profile and his statements about these shafts and his pictures of the designs of the shafts to realise just what an enormously complicated architectural task it was to build them. And you can only conclude the Egyptians must have had a really compelling reason to build these unique shafts in the body of the pyramid. And I'm not sure ventilation does. I'm not convinced the king's body was made into the tomb anyway. But maybe it's something to do with symbolism. I'm not saying this is going to be the last word on this subject. It might make some sense. If this were the Israelite chamber and the whole pyramid, the archetype, is a representation of the cosmos coming into being, then the iron is the iron of creation, it's a sample of the iron that's been, in the Egyptian mind, being blasted up from the earth into the sky to form the stars, and perhaps the idea was, symbolically at least, the iron was being dispatched up into the sky through these two shafts. So there is some plausibility to the idea of the shafts in the context of the Iron Intellect. So, if the king was not buried in the king's chamber, where might he have been buried? Primarily, my leaning is towards the subterranean location. However, before we look at the subterranean possibilities, let me just mention briefly the queen's chamber. I think the queen's chamber has to be considered as a possibility. I don't want to be dogmatic about it. I have a favourite theory which I'm going to come on to, which is subterranean, but I don't want to be dogmatic about it. It is possible that the king might have been buried in the so-called queen's chamber. It was very well concealed by a bridge of stone just here. And some interesting things about the queen's chamber, these shafts which are hidden inside of the walls actually provide the same access by which the king's chamber shafts are built. This is a rather complicated point to understand. But it suggests that these shafts are in the middle of the wall, so these are offset. And the position of these shafts is determined, dictated by the position of these. So these shafts, I know they end in strange doors, and don't really know why they were terminated. Maybe Dr. Hawass will enlighten us soon. But evidently, they were very, very important. Even though they remained sealed at the lower ends, as we'll see in a moment, they were evidently very, very important in the shafts. Could it be possible that the king was buried in the queen's chamber? This is where the stone bridge originally concealed the entrance to the queen's chamber. The queen's chamber is reached through this passage. And as you enter the queen's chamber, there's a corridor which, the height of which blocks. Maybe this was plugged in some way to protect entrance into this chamber. And the floor of the chamber is interesting because the floor stone that it gets up and removes. I don't subscribe to the theory that this chamber was unfinished. I believe it was finished. I agree with Lepre in his book, The Egyptian Pyramids. He argues that the floor stones were removed. And concludes they must have been made some attractive material, perhaps alabaster. Interesting feature in the queen's chamber is this niche, which the corbel design appeared first in the pyramids at Dahshur, which appears in the Grand Gallery here at the Great Pyramid, perhaps to provide relief from the pressures above going down. But in this context here, it's purely symbolic. There's no need for architectural relief here, and it's more calm. Evidently, there's some kind of symbolic or decorative elements in here. We think that this carries some kind of statue, maybe even though it's a certain degree of contents, but not so much. There's a tunnel dug in the back. We don't know by who, searching for a treasure or something. We don't know who did it or why we did it. I mentioned that because I know somebody will have a question. And the niche, obviously something important going on in this chamber, we really don't know, we can only speculate as to what it was. However, an Arab writer, if he saw in the 13th century, recorded seeing a sarcophagus in this chamber. Not there today, nobody knows what might have happened to it. It's possible it seems to have been out in the sun too much and got a bit confused. But he actually said there was a sarcophagus here, and upon seeing up to the king's chamber, they found another sarcophagus similar to the one they seen. So maybe the long burial, maybe there was a sarcophagus here, maybe this sarcophagus contains the tomb of Khufu. It is true that that queen's chamber is above ground level. However, the Egyptians did have a degree of flexibility and fluidity in the way they converted mythology into stone architecture. And a classic example of that, if you go forward in time to the 6th century pyramids, at Saqqara, what you'll find is you've got the tomb chamber underground, which represents the Duat, and then that leads into the Akhet prior to turning into the entrance passage. So the Akhet, what's interesting is the Akhet is positioned underground. Now that is an anomaly, strictly speaking, because the Akhet should be the gateway to the sky. And you'd almost imagine the Duat should be the underground tomb chamber, and really the passageway should then go up in the Akhet. Antechamber should really be positioned at ground level as the passage is about to go into the outside world. But they position the Akhet underground. That suggests a fluidity in approach, that they could actually move architectural forms, chambers, around a little bit to reflect the practicalities of building a secure thing. So on that basis, by the open to the possibility that the Queen's Chamber might possibly have been a Duat kind of chamber containing the body of the king. So it's not my favourite theory. This is just a photograph of the shafts which were opened up. Originally these were concealed by plates of stone. They were left uncut. You can see from the one on the north side very clearly that these originally were completely sealed up, left intact and uncut. Very mysterious and very difficult to explain easily. So coming back to my first issue, truly at the subterranean features of the Great Pyramid, firstly, the deal with the subterranean chamber, I think that's too obvious to be the tomb of Khufu. Because anybody's discovering the entrance, and probably the people who built the pyramid who did retain records, recollections, and passed down by word of mouth information about the pyramids they built. Hence so many pyramids were finished. Quite soon after they were built. Anyway, any intruder coming down here would proceed directly to the subterranean chamber. So probably 0 out of 10 for security, yes? Might have been a decoy thing that has to put intruders off the fence, make them think the pyramid had already been lost. But a few intruders would have been convinced by that, and I'm sure they would have kept looking for the true tomb. It's possible that knowledge was preserved. If you think about the pyramid of a building site and the work, so many workers engaged in building it, it is possible that these chambers did not remain that secret, and that during the Old Kingdom, first intermediate period, even over hundreds of years, it's possible that the knowledge of these unusual chambers, and I just think this is the largest pyramid ever built, legendary pyramid, it's quite plausible that knowledge of these chambers was passed down, and that the secret was not that well. So they might not have been that safe after all, as the burial of the king. A more secure possibility, I think, is the grotto. It's a tiny cave, which is very neglected by writers on the Great Pyramid. So it's orthodox and alternative, ignore it. But these are being quite tricky to access up a quite steep shaft through the gold shaft. Not many people have been there. I haven't been there. I haven't managed to gain permission to visit it. But a few Egyptologists later, Martin Amos and Atwell, George David Redway, the author of the Egyptian Pyramid, speaking up there, will see what he calls it later. And it's a very narrow cave. I'll show you this on diagrams in a moment. What I think happened is that the grotto, I suspect, was a sacred cave for centuries before the pyramid was built. For those of you who research ancient civilizations and their religions and mythologies, you probably know the cave is always a sacred spot. supernatural trade, chances are ancient people will be giving offerings to the gods of the underworld, in the sacred cave. And the sacred cave was often seen as a magical place of the center points of the creation in place. So, very plausible that there was a natural fissure in the rock leading down to this small cave, which was held to be sacred before the pyramid was built. So what would happen when Khufu decided to build a pyramid on top of it? Well, access to it would have been cut off, assuming this was the original ancient spirit. Access to it would have been sealed off. So I think a good theory for the well shaft and the building of the well shaft is to retain access to the grotto. Now this is an innovative theory, because these colleges believe the well shaft was cut to bring ventilation down to workers who were digging out this subterranean chamber. That's one of the theories. The other theory was that it was cut in order to allow the evacuation of the workmen from after the tomb was sealed by these granite blocks. It's believed these three granite blocks, each weighing 5 to 6 tons each, in order to be released, they had to be controlled from above as they were going down. And therefore, the workmen who built the blocks were imprisoned in part of the pyramid with their deceased king. And so this is on the assumption that people was very rough here. The idea was it wasn't evacuated, it had to evacuate the pyramid, and that's why this well shaft was cut. I'm not convinced, the reason I'm not convinced is if I was Khufu and if I was being buried here, I wouldn't want to create a back door route to my tomb. To create a back door route to the tomb makes the tomb much more vulnerable to robbery. So I would have said, hell with it, that would have been a guy in the gallery. I want my tomb intact, I don't want to expose the tomb holes. But anyway, I don't believe the author is there. This is another objection on my part to this idea of the well shaft. So I looked at the well shaft with fresh eyes and thought the most likely reason it is cut is to retain access to this place of code. Now here, the well shaft joins with the descending passage in the west side of the passage. And this is referred to by scholars as a secret door. They say a secret door, I think this is in Peter's words, referred to as a secret door. Actually, what it was a plate of stone, a camouflage plate of stone, which was inserted into the side of the passageway, which concealed the fact that there was an aperture in the passageway behind it. So this plate of stone was in effect a secret door to a secret passage, and this secret passage led up to this small sacred cave. My theory is that the mummy Khufu was introduced down into the subterranean chamber, which is the place of the primeval waters and duats, and was then rituals that had been performed, and then the mummy would have been dragged up there to a distance of 22 feet, and then maneuvered up through the well shaft and buried up here somewhere. And the priest then backtracked, concealed, filled the gap with the plate of stone and camouflaged the entrance and then came out of the pyramid. People outside the pyramid would have been on the rise and maybe only 2 or 3 people knew the secret of where Khufu was buried. This is simply another diagram of that well shaft. So I don't think we need to explain. Just to mention, in case anybody will ask me afterwards, about the top part of it. Interestingly, this XA or AX here is a tunnel, a rough cut tunnel, which I believe dates to after the pyramid was built. I don't personally believe that was part of the original design. Now, Egyptology 2 includes for them, it's crucial for their evacuation of the workmen that had to be there. I think it was cut from the bottom upwards by guardians of the pyramid following an earthquake and they wanted to inspect the damage to the King's Chamber. There's another matching tunnel above the King's Chamber, which leads me to believe this was an intrusion of the guardians of the pyramid. And it wasn't there at the time of the burial when the pyramid was first built. So the original shaft was terminated here. A little bit on the grotto, this is the ground plan of the grotto, showing the well shaft, which provides the entrance into the room. There's a few features such as a spray granite block. We're not quite sure where that came from. It might have originated from the portcullises outside the King's Chamber. There's a deep hole in the floor up here, which you see that again in the moment. and four levels on three levels. He's just about to stand up at the highest point. And in this part is quite tight, very good. And now I'll show you a vertical picture. This is the well shaft I was showing just now, which continued down and would have terminated here. And at the top of the well shaft is the doorway to the grotto, where the branch rock again. And there's the deep hole in the floor. This is about 6 feet by 6 feet. This tells me we're going through, because if Cooper was secretly buried in here, then this may be the place where he was buried, and perhaps the tomb was discovered in Manchester, which idea tells me the same. However, it could be a decoy. It could be it was done in the floor specifically for that reason, to pull people up when the tomb had been discovered in Manchester. And what struck me and piqued my curiosity about this paint is the bricks that line the well shaft here. The rest of the well shaft is cut from solid bedrock. But for this 10-feet section, 10-feet wide section here, the walls are made of stone blocks about a foot square. They're quite small and, oops, this is too sensitive, quite small and removable blocks. And it got me thinking, why is the well shaft lined with this stone cladding here and over here in this area? And I started to put two and two together, obviously I've got five, but I'll ask eventually one day, I hope we'll prove whether I'm right or not. And the other clue is explained by Lefroy. I'm going to show you in a moment what J.P. Lefroy wrote about. He's one of the few people that has visited the grotto, and he was particularly struck by the strange material of which the ceiling here is made. And this is what Lefroy has to say. Lefroy says, even more curious than the presence of this earth and cavity, this bag of earth in this natural cave, maybe the earth was brought in afterwards as part of the sanctity of this cave, we don't know. Even more curious than this is the fact that the grotto ceiling is composed not of packed earth, as would be expected, but of gravel packed in damp, caked sand. Whereas the earthen walls of this cavity are relatively hard to touch, the ceiling of small stones is so loosely packed that one can only reach up and dig in with one's fingers to extract whole handfuls of this material. M. Edgar corroborates this observation by stating that this ceiling crumbles when touched. This is a very unusual configuration, which would lead us to believe that perhaps the ceiling might represent an impromptu filling by the builders. And he goes on, he notices something else even more strange. The ceiling is also unusually damp to the point where there is actually a perceptible coating like a white frost over the pebbles. This unusual composition naturally tempts one to speculate about the existence of a nearby water source, even though a water source seems unlikely in the middle of a barren desert. And I was surprised at that point he didn't mention Herodotus, but all we think about Herodotus and maybe can sometimes spun a good story. But it is interesting that Herodotus claims that Khufu was buried underneath the pyramid on a kind of island surrounded by water. Anyway, so what that was, I'll just pop that in your direction before we measure it. Anyway, Lefroy went on and said, the closing of the ceiling of the grotto would appear to be in order, so it might prove to be a hazardous venture. I'd recommend going home after this. Getting in the grotto and drilling up into the area. Another interesting passage from Herodotus here, in History Book 2, Herodotus writes, to make the causeway of the Great Pyramid took 10 years. And then he says something really interesting, or rather, to make the causeway the works on the mounds where the pyramid stands and the underground chambers which Cheops intended as vaults for his own use. These blasts were filled from a sort of island surrounded by water induced from the Nile. It's now a strange observation to make. You can imagine Herodotus going to give an interview in Princeton. But it's so strange that he would refer here to the works on the mounds where the pyramid stands. Something of a strange thing to throw in there. Because there's something behind that. Well, let's just go back. I'm just about finished here, man. I just want to suggest that perhaps this grotto that we see today was originally part of a whole network of caves underneath the Great Pyramid. And these, there was a network of caves, and what the builders have done is to screen off this particular cave here from the other caves in order to conceal those other caves. And maybe the cladding of stone is designed to conceal entrance into those other caves. And that would account for why they're there. Because otherwise, it's a problem right away. And by my estimates, my calculations, I think there could be a secret entrance to a passageway up here on the south side, which might lead above the cave that we know into another network of caves. And it's perfectly plausible that the mummy of Khufu's dragged up the shaft, and that these blocks were, a couple of these blocks were temporarily removed to allow the mummy to be inserted into the passageway and concealed in this network of caves at ground level underneath the pyramid. And then the stones were inserted back in the wall, and the priest had trapped down the shaft. Brilliant. It is so. Brilliant security. A place that would never be found. And perfectly in accord with the axiom, the body to earth, the spirit to the sky. Burying the king, the most symbolic, magical place in the Great Pyramid. Namely, the symbolic place of the primeval man, the creation. And so I've been in some correspondence with Dr. Haller proposing that the first thing to do is to get a small portable ground penetrating radar unit and see if there is a gap behind the stone. If you find any kind of aperture behind there, or hole that is, because you could be on the verge of an incredible stuff. And the people I've spoken to, even people who don't agree with me about the tomb of Khufu, they've all said to me consistently, even if the tomb of Khufu is not there, we support the proposal to examine the grotto or the ceiling, the stone walls, exactly as you suggest. Because even if you don't find the tomb of Khufu, you might just find something very interesting to do. I think that concludes my talk. So thank you.